Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Last week, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a dire report saying we only have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown. Deborah Roberts, a co-chair of the IPCC working group, said, quote, "It's a line in the sand, and what it says to our species is that this is the moment and we must act now. This is the largest clarion bell for the science community, and I hope it mobilizes people and dents the mood of complacency." End quote. As governments around the world reacted to the report with calls for urgent changes, the climate deniers in the White House continue to ignore and diminish scientific research. The Environmental Protection Agency recently announced a plan to eliminate the agency's chief science advisor. There are also ongoing discussions to allow exposure to higher levels of radiation and other toxins, and to ignore research collected in studies that include anonymous participants, which is standard scientific practice. Well, joining us to talk about the report and how scientists should respond and how they are responding is Audra Wolf. Audra is a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. It's about how the American idea of science being removed from politics originally was a propaganda tool developed to counter communist science. But she argues that science is in fact political by nature, and scientists need to get off the fence and change the way they talk about their work. Audra Wolf has taught classes on science, medicine, and the media at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Hi, Audra. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, I have to say, I always struggle with these shows that we do now about climate change, given who's in the White House and the realities that we're facing with climate deniers really making the decisions. And I wonder, as a historian of science, how do you see? I mean, how do you kind of explain where we are right now? I mean, there's so many things happening right in front of our eyes. We don't even need a report to tell us that we need to act now. And yet, with these people in the White House, they're just taking us backwards.
Right. I think you're very right to be concerned. And when we look at all of the changes that have happened with the Trump administration, some of the biggest have had to do with its attitude towards science. So it's not just that there are active climate change deniers in the White House, but regular scientists have largely been sidelined from advising. So, for instance, the White House has an Office of Science and Technology Policy, and the head of that office has traditionally been the president's science advisor. The head of that office has been empty since the inauguration, since January 2017. It's the longest time that there hasn't been someone in a presidential science advisory position since the position was created in the Eisenhower administration.
Wow.
So there's a real vacuum of science advice. And then aside from the vacuum, the other thing that's quite different, that is a fairly dramatic sea change, is dropping the pretense that the science advice that the administrations would be getting wouldn't be affected by politics, that what they would desire would be nonpartisan advice. Now, obviously, over time, some of the advice has not always been nonpartisan. But various people have, the administrations have generally wanted to pretend or at least talk as if it were. And that's something that the current administration just isn't interested in doing. It actively endorses various litmus tests for various scientific positions. And it's been a real problem both in filling positions, a desire to fill positions, and in keeping people in their jobs.
So again, as a historian of science, how should the public, I don't want to say make sense of this, but really understand what's happening? Because with so much news coming out on a daily basis, I mean, there's great reporting on what's happening with the EPA and the oil, gas, and coal industry and the influence they have on the White House. But you really have to look for it and take the time to read these lengthy articles. So at this point, what are your thoughts about how the public should understand about what we're truly facing with this administration in power?
Right. There's so much information and everything seems to be happening all at once. So, you know, as you mentioned, there was wonderful reporting about some of these recent changes in the EPA, but it was only in a handful of outlets and it was deep reporting. But you know, it was there. I think citizens who are hoping to find information about it, you know, following experienced reporters on the science policy beat is a good place to start. Paying attention to what's happening with the folks behind the March for Science and some of the associated movements with that. People who are really motivated can follow some of the news in the kind of science policy magazines that also include scientific information. So, for instance, Science Magazine, the front of Science Magazine is always about science policy, and it's an excellent source for this. But in general, just sort of kind of actively being aware that we're facing both real-time obvious crises, whether this might be something about family separation, but we're also facing much longer-term crises, whether it's climate change or environmental regulation. And so we have to have a deep attention span and a wide attention span to pay attention not just to the immediate fires, but kind of the long-term damage that's happening in our ability to deal with any number of crises.
Audra Wolf is a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. She wrote a piece recently for The Washington Post called Yes, Radiation is Bad for You. The EPA's transparency rule would be even worse. And we'll also talk about that on today's show. Now I would like to welcome Michael Halpern to the show. Michael is Deputy Director for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Michael defends scientists from harassment, helps scientists more effectively engage the public, and he works to ensure government decisions are fully informed by scientific information. And Michael Halpern joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. I was just telling Audra, I think you came in a little late, we do shows about climate change and overfishing and plastic pollution. I mean, all of these issues every Monday. And I just, it's so difficult to do these shows with the climate deniers in the White House, because you read articles about how, I mean, there's so much. The EPA announcing plans to eliminate the agency's chief science advisor, that they're not taking this IPCC report seriously. And, you know, one of the things in your bio that really stands out is you have to defend scientists from harassment. So why don't we start off by talking about that? What are scientists really dealing with in this political climate?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that we is great about science is that it informs everything, that many of the decisions we make, either on a personal basis or on a societal basis, have a significant scientific component. And as a result, it gets treated like a political football. So politicians like to sort of deep six the scientific information that doesn't support them and try to champion the information that does support the policy views that they want to put forward. And so when scientists come up with inconvenient information and research, whether it's on fracking or on air pollution or other issues that impact human health and the environment, they often find themselves at the receiving end of hostility or attacks from politicians, from industry, and those attacks can take a lot of different forms. It can be through subpoenas or lawsuits. It can also be by attacking someone in the scientific literature or in the popular press. And scientists generally are not trained to in that kind of combat. You know, most of their conversations happen with other scientists, and they criticize each other's work in a very sort of civilized and constructive way, and the rough and tumble world of politics tends to be pretty foreign to them.
What has really changed for scientists and their relationship with the public under this administration?
Well, we find that they're mostly being sidelined from a lot of environmental and public health decisions. And some agencies, like the Food and Drug Administration, things are actually humming along pretty well. And scientists who work for the FDA and advise the FDA are finding that they're being listened to. But when it comes to the EPA and the Department of Interior and other agencies that are more environmentally focused, we find that there are many steps that are being taken to redefine what kinds of science can be incorporated into decisions, to prevent independent researchers from providing scientific advice to the agency by censoring scientists who work for these departments, and really going the extra mile to try to both demonstrate that science is not welcome in either DOI or the EPA, and that it's much more, and that decisions are going to move forward without adequate scientific expertise. Now, the good news is that a lot of these decisions that are being made in a vacuum by political appointees are either being exposed publicly for what they are, which are political, not science-based decisions, or they're being struck down by the courts. So under Administrator Scott Pruitt, there was a decision around the chemical chlorpyrifos, which is used widely on farms all around the country. And the science, you know, recent science has found that it can damage children's developing brains. And so a lot of places around the world have banned the chemical. The EPA scientists suggested banning the chemical, and we're moving forward with that. And former Administrator Scott Pruitt reversed that decision and said, well, we're going to allow it to be on the market. Well, a court stepped in and said, you know what, you didn't show your work here. There's no scientific basis for this decision that you just made. And so, you know, we're striking this down, and you guys have to go back to the drawing board and take steps to remove it from the public. So the good thing is that there are people who are paying attention, mm-hmm. That scientists are speaking up, and that both the public and the courts are responding accordingly.
I'm guessing that a lot of people don't know what really goes on at the EPA, how reports are completed, how decisions are made. And the Washington Post reported that during the first 18 months of the Trump administration, nearly 1,600 workers left the EPA. And that includes at least 260 scientists, 180 environmental protection specialists, and 106 engineers. Some of these people have worked at the EPA for decades. I mean, they dedicate their lives to really serving the public and trying to ensure that, you know, we have clean water, clean air. What does it mean that so many scientists have left the EPA?
Well, and you're totally right that these are scientists who really have spent their lives in public service. You know, they don't want to come up with the newest, best fabric softener. They want to really help society and use their expertise in that way. And it is regrettable that they have left, and the loss of this kind of expertise and the loss of this kind of long-term capacity will have impacts long after President Trump leaves office, because it takes decades to really build up that institutional memory and institutional knowledge to not only so that you kind of understand how the systems work within the agency to be effective advocates for science, but that you understand how most effectively to use that science in the science that you develop and analyze in making decisions. A lot of the laws that EPA is authorized to carry out, whether it's the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act, are grounded in the best available scientific information, and they require the agency to really base its work in that way. And a lot of the activities we've seen have either, you know, pushed people out directly, or, you know, discouraged them from continuing to serve in government positions. And so I think it's going to be felt for a long time, and we'll need to figure out ways to create that pipeline again so that it becomes really sexy and really interesting to enter government service once we have an administration that's less hostile to the work of federal government scientists.
Audra, what would you say about the significance of so many scientists, environmental protection specialists, and engineers leaving the EPA?
Well, it's not just the loss of the specific expertise. Part of what's happening is a broader transition that is in some ways even more nefarious, in which actually being associated with the EPA is in some ways being seen as a conflict of interest. So it's not simply the employees who are leaving, but one of the changes that's happened with the EPA science advising over the past year or so Is that Scott Pruitt said that people who had received grants from researchers who had received grants from the EPA in the past could no longer serve on the EPA science advisory boards because it would constitute a conflict of interest. So, of course, these are many of the researchers who are researching environmental contaminants or toxicology. Those are exactly the people who would have the knowledge that you want. But because they had received funds from the EPA, it was considered a conflict of interest. Meanwhile, those people who had been involved in lawsuits against the EPA, that was not considered a conflict of interest. So part of what's happened is that we have these advisory boards that now are often packed with people who actively have opposed the EPA, whereas those scientists who actually have knowledge are being actively excluded from it. So it's not just that the scientists are discouraged from staying into their positions and they're feeling that the positions are unrewarding. There are some other ways in which active scientists with knowledge about the matters at hand are being actively excluded from participating in the process.
Michael, you have worked with EPA scientists under three different administrations. Are you still in touch with people who work at the EPA, and what are you hearing from them?
We're hearing that they are determined to continue to do their jobs unless they're told otherwise. I know these are people who will keep their nose down and do the best they can and communicate out their science as they're able to. And we're also working with a lot of ex-EPA scientists, either people who have left the agency or have retired, to both get information out of the agency about bad things that are happening, as well as helping to explain, you know, publicly why these types of scientific positions matter. And I think there's, you know, the people who are there over the long term that we've been talking about, but the EPA and other agencies also have these incredible fellowships that give scientists real-world policy experience and give them a foothold to enter public service. Those fellowships have been largely shut down, and so you're stopping the next generation from really developing the skills that will be necessary to inform public health and environmental protections in the future. And so, you know, all of the different actions that we've seen taken together really have sidelined science from these agencies and weakened them. But we do find that the people inside still are dedicated to doing their jobs and doing their work and spending time documenting what's happening. Another challenge that we had last year, at least under Scott Pruitt, was that a lot of scientists were being discouraged even from taking notes in meetings, so as not to create any kind of record that then could be used to prove that these actions are being taken in a non-scientific way. And so we worked with other organizations to develop guidance for scientists and what rights they have to take notes, both personal notes and professional notes, so that they're able to do their work and they're able to document what's actually happening within the agency.
Audra, are you in touch with anyone who still works at the EPA?
Those aren't quite my networks. I know a lot about people who worked in federal agencies 50 years ago, but contemporary agencies, not so much. But I'm extremely grateful for the work that that Michael and his colleagues have been doing at UCS. You had asked earlier about ways that that members of the public can find out about what's going on. Some of the resources that the Union of Concerned Scientists have been putting together are really one of the best places for members of the public who want to follow these issues. I highly recommend the work that they're doing.
Mm. Audra Wolf is a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. The book is about how the American idea of science being removed from politics originally was a propaganda tool developed to counter communist science. But Audra argues that science is in fact political by nature, and scientists need to get off the fence and change the way they talk about their work. Audra Wolf has taught classes on science, medicine, and the media at the University of Pennsylvania. We're also joined today by Michael Halpern, Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Michael defends scientists from harassment. He helps scientists more effectively engage the public, and he works to ensure government decisions are fully informed by scientific information. And if you have any questions for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a scientist, How are you making sense of what we're dealing with right now? How does politics affect your job? What are your thoughts about the new IPCC report that says we only have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then if you're just completely overwhelmed and, well, depressed can come into the sentence, depressed about what's happening right now with the environment and the climate deniers in the White House and who is really making the decisions, you can give us a call if you have any questions about where we are and what is most effective, what you can do, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Well, let's talk about the IPCC report that was released just last week. It's getting a lot of print attention. I wish it got more attention on the cable shows. They are just focused on Trump, 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 but this deserves so much more attention. Michael, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, the overall message is the report says we have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown. What were your takeaways from the report?
Well, so yeah, so the report itself, you know, underscores the fact that the bigger global warming that we have, the greater the risks and impacts for society will be. So it really underscores the urgency of ramping up climate action at this point. And, you know, we get a lot of attention towards what's happening within the White House and at the federal level and the lack of leadership that we see on climate change. That's pretty profound. But there is a lot that's happening at the state and local level, that where states like California are really stepping up to fill the void, and to, because they're the ones that are dealing with the impacts of more droughts, of storms that are worse, and I know of higher precipitation and other challenges. And so, you know, limiting warming to either 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius is going to require not just, you know, small changes, but really transformational changes that, you know, change how we use energy, how we grow and consume food. And we have a lot of these technologies in hand now. You know, we have the tools that we need to solve this. We just need the political will to move forward.
Hmm. What would you add, Audra?
Yeah, I think I would underscore the idea that these are political decisions to be made. And one of the things that made this most recent report so much different than the prior reports was the way that it embraced urgency and the way that it embraced an emotional response to urgency. I think some of the prior IPCC reports have really kind of tamped down on that. They were concerned that if it seemed too emotional, too urgent, too upset, that it might come off as seeming like a political document instead of a scientific document. And I think by now everyone has realized, you know, it's too late for that. The time window in which we can address these changes is very, very small. Mm. It requires action now. And so the current report very much feels like a document, you know, that's basically saying we need to address this problem right now. And it's not that scientists are necessarily the people who should be making decisions in democracies, right? That would be a technocracy. But we have all of these decisions, political decisions, policy decisions, whether they're about climate change or whether they're about regulating radiation, that require scientific knowledge. And so that's the vacuum. That's where we're not. The policymakers just aren't accessing that advice right now on the federal level. As Michael mentioned, at the state level and at the city level, there's many smaller initiatives. But the problem is so vast that it takes federal action, and mm-hmm. it takes united federal action from any number of countries to address this. And with the United States withdrawing from the Paris Climate Agreement, it feels like it's one of our last moments to be able to address this on the scale that's necessary.
Audra Wolf is a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. She's taught classes on science, medicine, and the media at the University of Pennsylvania. We're also joined by Michael Halpern, deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And on today's Your Call, it is our One Planet series. We are talking about the new UN report that says we have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown. What does this mean when we have climate deniers in the White House ignoring and diminishing scientific research. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a very inspiring show with young environmentalists who are this year's Brower Youth Award winners. They recognize young leaders in the environmental movement. They're saving key pollinator species. They're fighting oil pipelines on indigenous lands. They're building inclusive movements to protect the planet and those most affected by climate change. So I hope you can join us for that. Today, we are talking about the new UN report. It was a dire report saying we only have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown. This got a lot of media attention. Governments around the world reacted with calls for urgent changes. But the climate deniers in the White House continue to ignore and diminish scientific research. If you have a question or a comment about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today we're joined by Audra Wolfe, a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science, and Michael Halpern, deputy director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have a question from Alfred on Facebook. He says, to bring up another issue, faith in these agencies has been eroding for years now, albeit at an accelerated rate lately. The infiltration of industry lobbyists and political operatives has made these agencies seem more like an arm of special interests instead of scientific regulatory institutions. What do we do when a particular group controls the legislature, the courts, and these agencies? Audra, do you want to take that one first?
Sure. I think part of what we need to do is to recognize that all of us benefit, no matter what your partisan background is, all of us benefit when policies are based on, real data and actual, some facts. Now, obviously, in any system of fact gathering, any system of science, wearing my historian of science cap, all of these are obviously influenced. You can't have science outside of its context, right? So, but nevertheless, scientists have ways of negotiating the kinds of different backgrounds, different agendas that go into scientific research, whether that's through peer review or consensus-based work. Over time, the better science emerges. And so scientists have ways of overcoming some of those ways that human elements of scientific research creep into the data, right, through peer review and through consensus research. So I think continuing to push to keep scientists in these roles to make sure that that there's not a vacuum. And I think most recently, these issues about what the EPA is calling the transparency rule, that rule would make it more difficult for regulators in the government to access scientific information. It has a very Orwellian kind of name, this transparency rule. And the Department of the Interior has a similar rule called the Open Science Rule. And it's based, both of these were based on a failed piece of legislation called the Honest Act. So all of these pieces of legislation have very, doublespeak sort of names about introducing more transparency. And they're actually doing just the opposite. They're trying to actively remove scientific information from policymakers' toolkit. So what we can do is we can push back against this. There was an enormous response to the EPA's transparency rule comment period, many hundreds of thousands of comments. Many dozens of scientific organizations have written letters expressing their concerns. If you're a scientist, you can speak up, and you can encourage your professional organizations to speak up. If you're a citizen, you can write letters, and you can certainly contact your congresspeople. But in general, paying attention and knowing what's happening in the first place is really critical to this. And understanding when some of this language of transparency or openness is actually intended to do the opposite.
And Michael, what would you add?
Well, the most radical change that we've seen with regard to this administration is that the regulated industries have become the regulators. So the people who hold the top positions within EPA, it doesn't matter as much whether or not they accept the science on climate change. What matters is that they've come from industries that really have been fighting the EPA tooth and nail for years. And, you know, we heard a lot at the beginning of this administration about the idea of deconstruction of the administrative state, where the idea that all of these agencies are just there for bureaucracy and not there to protect human health and the environment. And I think, you know, faith in these agencies has certainly been deteriorating, but so has faith in a lot of different institutions, whether it's the military or the judiciary or the media, and a lot of that is intentional because you end up with, it's a lot easier to sort of rig the system if you are setting up these kinds of expectations that every decision is political, that nobody can be trusted, that everybody has an agenda, including scientists, including judges, including everyone else. So the way to combat that, I think, is really to point out the impact of these kinds of actions and the impact that it has on human health and the environment. And you know, I can tell you one example of where we have seen a lot of shift and change, and that was with regard to this project called the Data Refuge Project, where scientists and, you know, or archivists and librarians and other people who were concerned about the disappearance of federal government data because of the fact that a lot of the climate deniers were entering the White House and entering federal agencies, they downloaded gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of federal government data and got a lot of attention for that effort, and in the process explained to people why data matters, why it matters to California that the NASA satellites continue to give us information about the climate. And so, you know, it's really important to tell those stories and to talk about real impacts that there are on American health and safety and our long-term sustainability of our planet and our country.
Yes, and I think that's also so important to talk about the health effects, because a lot of good reporting has come out recently about what air pollution does to our body and our brains. And Bloomberg Environment released 26 regulations issued during the Obama administration that the Trump administration is trying to get rid of. This just came out a couple months ago. And just a few, these have already been overturned. Requirements for oil and gas companies to report methane emission leaks, rule that limits toxic emissions from industrial facilities, rule that prohibits hydrofluorocarbons as replacements for ozone-depleting compounds, a proposed rule to reduce air pollutants from sewage treatment plants, and then other rules in the process of being overturned. It's so long. Emission standards for trailers, standards for limiting carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. I mean, on and on and on. And Audra, it, you know, it's so important because this really does affect human health.
Yeah, it's an incredibly depressing list when you read them off like that. And it seems to me that a lot of these issues about kind of air pollutants are really the centerpiece of what the EPA is trying to get at by changing some of its administrative rules. One of the so the wording of this proposed transparency rule basically suggests that regulators can only use studies for which the researchers have provided all underlying data, sort of raw data. And there are a couple of concerns about that. One is about proprietary data. One is about personal information, for instance, personal health information for people who have been affected by various issues. And then there's a separate issue about older studies where the data don't necessarily exist anymore. But to go back to the one with the personal health information, there's a study called the Six Cities Study. That's an extremely important longitudinal study that talks about you know, the long-term effects of many of the pollutants that you've just mentioned, whether it's about, you know, ozone or whether it's about certain particulates. And that particular study promised its participants confidentiality. So the way that the transparency rule is originally worded, you would have to redact every patient's information. It would be an extremely time-consuming operation. It could happen eventually, but it's another way of kind of throwing gum into the works and slowing down the regulatory process so that it becomes harder and harder and harder for these regulatory agencies to access the information about health, about safety on a timely basis to protect the public's health.
And Michael, we're going to get to calls in just a minute, but one more question on pollution. The Washington Post recently reported that the EPA dismissed dozens of outside scientists who were charged with advising the agency on how to set air pollution standards. Instead, the EPA has decided to let a 7-member group called the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee alone perform these assessments. Can you talk about what this change means and why this is so important?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it means that on basically on smog and soot, that the EPA just won't have access to independent scientific information as it moves forward to make decisions around public health and safety. And they're widely expected to try their best to work the process as efficiently as possible to try to weaken these air pollution standards by the end of 2020. The science would clearly get in the way. We've seen in previous administrations, under the George W. Bush administration, the scientists who were advising the EPA strongly criticized the EPA's decision when it was not grounded in the best available science and when it was not scientifically credible. So the decision this time around is just to get rid of those scientists entirely, so they're not in a position to create that criticism of what may end up being a not a science-based decision. And these have significant impacts on public health, and a decision not to move forward with a more protective standard means that more people will get sick and that more people will die.
Michael Halpern is Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Audra Wolf is a historian of science and author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. This is Your Calls One Planet series. And today we are really giving you an overview of what's happening under the Trump administration and the scientists that are leaving the EPA, the scientists that are being let go at a time when we need to take just major, major action on climate change. The UN came out with a report that says we have about 12 years to avoid a catastrophic environmental breakdown. Some scientists say that report doesn't go far enough, including Michael Mann, who's been on the show many times. Let's hear from our listeners. Let's go to Larry in Berkeley. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm Larry. I'm in Berkeley. You know, I would like to keep my money, what little I have, and spend it on myself and a few friends. But if I'm going to survive being part of the greater reality, how will I go about being someone who has a little bit of money to give, giving it as intelligently as possible? How would you help me in that challenge?
To an environmental organization?
Yes.
Audra, what are your thoughts on that?
I would say go local. One of the most effective ways, so when we think about how to fight climate change, there are these large-scale federal actions. And of course, there are actions that individuals can take. But sort of on the middle level, when we think about how to fight climate change, what we're really talking about is fighting the expansion of the fossil fuel industry. And so there are any number of grassroots environmental justice organizations throughout the country. These organizations can really make good use of your funds. So whether it's fighting a pipeline or whether it's fighting a new gas-fired electric conversion plant or something in your community, there are existing groups that are doing this that can absolutely benefit from dollars and time.
And Michael, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, and I would add to that, the people who are hurt the most by these policy, by the lack of action at the federal level, or by the destruction of the Environmental Justice Office at EPA, or other problems that we've seen, are people of color and low-income communities. They tend to bear more of the burden of environmental contaminants and have relatively less power than some other people who don't have that much exposure to those kinds of contaminants. So I agree with going local and looking at funding those organizations that are fighting to eliminate those kinds of health disparities that we see too much.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because NPR had a piece about the hurricane in Florida, which has really hit poor communities so hard, and people were interviewed saying, you know, people we work with and service are living paycheck to paycheck, and they cannot leave this area. They have nowhere to go. I mean, we're hearing this more and more, Michael, across
Certainly,
the country
yeah,
and obviously around the globe.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, evacuating costs money, and you can't do it every time, and you can, sometimes can't even do it once. You know, sometimes people get criticized for not leaving, and you know, all of that takes resources, and it is generally you know, the people with fewer resources that are going to be the most impacted by our changing climate and the public health and environmental consequences of that, and you're right, not only just here at home, but all the way around the world, and that has impact on those individuals and also creates a lot of instability in terms of our, you know, our global political environment.
Well, Larry, I hope that helps, and there are really incredible local organizations doing great work in Berkeley and Richmond, indigenous-led organizations. So I hope that helps. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Romy in San Francisco. Hi, Romy.
Hi, guys. As I was waiting for the phone call, the recycling truck blocked my car, and they were doing their job beautifully. I wanted to ask everybody about this. I heard a statistic the other day that in the U.S. we recycle 9% of our plastics, and that in Europe we recycle about 35%. I thought they were both quite low, but I was shocked to hear that about the U.S. And my question is, what responsibility do the producers of these consumer goods, everything that's a product, everything that's packaged, my background is food industry, and I've seen how that has progressed into so many products and so many packaged products that come in a bag and come in a box, etc. What, like, when you have a society designed around consumerism, I always look at where does all that garbage go? Where does all that plastic go? How does it end in the sea? Like, what is something that it seems like what I can do, it's very small, even though I have a very environmentally conscious family and extended family.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Romy. I was sitting here shaking my head because we've done shows about plastic for so over a decade on this show. We did one show actually calling out the companies that produce all of the plastic, because you're right. In many ways, the onus is on the individual. And yes, we should be responsible. But what about the corporations, Audra, that, you know, package all this stuff and are pushing plastic? And when we have, for example, plastic bag, you know, propositions on the ballot, they spend millions of dollars to overturn it. You know, what about the responsibility of the corporations that are causing these problems?
Well, they have an enormous responsibility to do something about that. But in some ways, even focusing on consumer goods misses this broader point about the broader relationship between growth economies and the carbon economy. So yes, the plastic production and even the energy that goes into recycling takes a lot of energy. But so do things like mining bitcoins or keeping backup servers so that you can run searches on Google all the time, or that you can keep all of your photos in the cloud, or the number of times that we go on airplanes, let alone coal-fired, you know, generating electricity. So yes, I would say producers of these, you know, producers have an enormous responsibility in kind of cutting back and trying to find ways to use less energy and less stuff to extract value. But there's a much, much broader problem here about the relationship, you know, assuming that economies have to be based on growth. It's not clear that that is sustainable if you are going to cut emissions to stay within the 1.5 degrees Celsius that the IPCC is saying is pretty necessary.
Yeah. What would you add, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I'd add we tend to try to focus on small things like straws when we really do need to be thinking a lot more broadly. And people certainly can do things individually, like making sure that their homes are energy efficient. I mean, just doing an energy audit on your house makes a big difference, or cutting back on red meat, or looking at commuting patterns. But ultimately, these are, you know, societal challenges that will need societal solutions. And you know, in terms of California, I know that this, you know, we have a lot of staff there who work on improving the infrastructure in California so that people can make more, you know, smarter choices. And, you know, the biggest challenges now in California are really making sure that we reduce emissions from the transportation sector and reduce being too reliant on natural gas and ensuring that we're able to prepare for the climate impacts on, you know, the water supply and infrastructure, and that we're able to really innovate our way forward.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up just the different things people can do, because meat and dairy are now starting to get a lot more attention from these reports and environmental groups overall. Michael?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it takes about 16 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef, which is not terribly efficient.
Right.
And you add the methane emissions that come from cows, and a lot of that, you know, that all adds up into creating more carbon into the atmosphere and creating other pollutants that make climate change worse as well. So, we do need to make choices at the individual level as well as impacting society through policy too.
And before we end the show, I want to make sure we talk about the differences between 1.5 versus 2 degrees. I mean, there's a huge difference. It might seem small, but when you're talking about animal survival, coral reefs, I mean, this is huge. Can you talk about that, Michael?
Sure. Yeah, and you know, it's certainly true that in general, the worse, you know, the difference is profound. The difference between that 1.5 degree and 2 degree world is striking in a lot of different ways, and the impacts are irreversible. So, you know, if global warming reaches 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial levels, we're going to be likely to lose a vast majority of the coral reefs, but at 2 degrees, we're likely to lose virtually all of them. You know, the warming, if it goes well above 1.5, puts a lot of ice sheets at risk of becoming very unstable, which could really trigger catastrophic sea level rise. And so we're not there. We're nowhere near on track to meet the goals that we need to make. You know, current commitments have us on track to reach a level of global warming that's closer to 3 degrees, which is far above, you know, 2 degrees. And as a result, we need to ramp up climate action now in a very profound way.
Well, Romy, thank you for calling, and we'll definitely do another show about packaging and plastic. We have an email from Danielle who says, I honestly think that the extreme Republican ethos is one of rape culture, to put it bluntly. I agree with George Lakoff's assessment of the Republican credo, man over woman, man over nature, adult over child, whites over people of color. Given that these are all power plays, they will do anything to win. And this is what's happening in regards to climate. They line their pockets to get theirs while essentially raping the land. The alternative healthy view is that we are not hierarchical, but are part of a circle that must work together and show respect for each other and the environment. Metaphorically, it's a battle between the earth is flat and the earth is round, and the environmentalists need to do a better job of calling out those that do us all harm. Audra, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes. I would say that that's it's a profoundly insightful and moving way of thinking about what's happening here. This is not it is in some ways a scorched earth approach to the problem, and we have to find new ways to talk about it. It's urgent. It's essential to the future of the planet.
When you talk to scientists, what are the conversations like when you say that we need a new way to talk about it?
Well, I think a lot of scientists still feel, because so many of them are getting new kinds of attacks, the default has been to retreat into data and to retreat into the protections of objectivity. But objectivity isn't going to protect scientists. You know, we know that climate change is already having effects now. The vast majority of scientists do agree that climate change is happening and that it's anthropogenic, but you don't even have to agree on those issues to see that communities of color, that low-income communities, the communities in the global south are already experiencing the effects of these things. So when I talk to scientists, I urge them to embrace the politics that are around them, that they can pick a side. They can pick a side if they want to be on the side of low-income communities that are losing their homes to extreme weather and floods. They can pick a side about these kinds of issues, even if there is still debate, and there's not real scientific debate, but even if there are people in politics who claim there is a debate, you can pick a side even if the debate isn't ended.
Well, and again, I mean, Michael, we've got about a minute left. If you look at studies, even from the Pew Research Center, the overwhelming majority of the country, over 70%, believe that something needs to be done about climate change. It's just extremists, the extremists in the White House, extremists in state legislatures, who are not taking action and are taking us backwards.
Yeah, actually, you know, that head-in-the-sand mentality just isn't working. And I think, you know, we need to make sure that we communicate to policymakers that there will be consequences if they continue to take that outlook. And scientists in general, they understand that science more and more is being hashed over, and that if they're not part of the conversation or not part of the discussion, that they're going to be left out on the sidelines, and the science is going to be misrepresented. So they know that they have to set the record straight. They know that they need to talk about values, and they're gaining the skills to do so through lots of different programs that are training them to engage more effectively in public life.
Michael Halpern is Deputy Director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He defends scientists from harassment and helps scientists effectively engage with the public. Audra Wolf is a historian of science, and she has taught classes on science at the University of Pennsylvania. She's author of the forthcoming book, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. Michael and Audra, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with three honorees of this year's Brower Youth Awards, which recognizes young leaders in the environmental movement. Where do young people see this movement going? What do they think about where we are right now with climate deniers in the White House? What issues do they find most urgent, and how can we support them? That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Andrew Stelter for producing today's show. Thanks to Laura Wenis for line producing. And thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.